There was misty movement and confusion. The colours of the umbrellas ran and starred and confused his eye. He saw a distorted image of Ephraim Tafari vault down lightly from the hatchway. Daniel had expected him to pose theatrically above the heads of the crowd and perhaps make a brief speech, but he vanished instantly. Though Daniel tried desperately to keep the crosshairs on him, somebody raised a wet umbrella and held it over him. Ning Cheng Gong's misty figure appeared in the hatchway, distracting Daniel's concentration. He swung the sights back towards Cheng and then stopped himself. It had to be Tafari first. Desperately, he swung the telescope back and forth, questing for a view of his target. The welcoming delegation had crowded around Tafari, umbrellas raised, obscuring him completely. The rain struck the concrete pad with such force that each drop exploded in a burst of spray. Rain was splattering against the lens of the telescope sight and streaming down Daniel's face beneath the mask. Haita paratroopers were jumping down from the helicopter and clustering around their president. No sign of Tafari now, and everybody was running towards the waiting Land Rovers, crouched down under the lofted umbrellas, splashing through the pools of rainwater. Tafari appeared again, stepping out fast in the slanting rain, heading for the leading vehicle. Even at a walking pace, and taking into account the velocity of the 7mm bullet, Daniel would have to lead him by 2 feet or more. He could barely distinguish him through the clouded lens. It was an almost impossible shot, but he tightened up on the trigger, just as one of the Haita bodyguards ran forward to assist his master. The shot went off before Daniel could stop himself. He saw the Haita paratrooper spin round and go down, shot through the chest. It would have killed Tafari as cleanly if the man had not covered him. The whole pattern of moving men in the rain exploded. Tafari threw down the umbrella he carried and darted forward. All around him men were running in confusion. Daniel jacked another round into the chamber of the rifle and fired again, a snapshot at Tafari. It had no effect. A clean miss. Tafari kept running. He reached the Land Rover, and before Daniel could reload, he had jerked open the door and thrown himself in the front seat of the vehicle. Daniel glimpsed Ning Cheng Gong in the thick of it, and fired again. He saw another paratrooper go down on his knees, hit low in the body, and then the other soldiers were blazing away wildly towards the edges of the forest, uncertain from which direction Daniel's shots were coming. Daniel was still trying desperately to get another shot at Tafari, but the Land Rover was pulling away. He fired at the head he could see behind the windscreen, not certain whether it was Tafari or a driver. The windscreen shattered, but the vehicle did not check or swerve. He emptied the magazine at the accelerating vehicle. Then, as he tried to reload from the bandolier at his waist, he saw three or four of the Haita guards and the civilian officials take hits and go down sprawling in the rain. There was the swelling clatter of small arms fire. The men of his own commando had opened fire from their positions in the forest outside the perimeter. The uprising had begun, but Tafari was still alive. Daniel saw the Land Rover make a wide circle, swinging past the office building and coming back round under the hovering helicopter. The Puma was hanging 20 feet above the ground, almost hidden by the falling curtains of rain. Tafari was leaning out of the driver's window, signalling frantically for the pilot to pick him up again. At that moment, a man appeared out of the jungle on the far side of the clearing. Even at this distance, Daniel recognised Morgan Tembe, the Matabele instructor. He carried the tube of an RPG rocket launcher on his shoulder as he raced forward. None of the Haita bodyguards seemed to have spotted him. 100 paces from the hovering Puma, Morgan dropped on one knee, steadied himself, and fired a rocket. It rode on a tail of white smoke, whooshing in to hit the Puma well forward, almost in line with the Perspex pilot's canopy. The cockpit and the pilot in it were obliterated by the burst of smoke and flame. The Puma performed a lazy cartwheel in the air and fell to earth on its back. The spinning rotors smashed themselves into tiny fragments on the concrete landing pad. An instant later, a ball of fire and black smoke devoured the machine. Morgan Tembe jumped to his feet and ran back towards the edge of the forest. He never made it. The Haita bodyguards shot him down long before he could reach cover. But he had cut off Tafari's escape. It had taken less than a minute, but already the Haita were recovering from the shock of the surprise attack. They were piling into Land Rovers and following Tafari as he drove for the roadway beyond the office building. Tafari must have realised the strength and numbers of the attackers and decided that his best bet would be to try and break out and reach the nearest roadblock on the Sengi Sengi Road, which was manned by his own men. Three Land Rovers filled with his own guards were flying after him. Most of the civilian officials were lying flat on the ground, trying to keep below the wild crossfire, although some of them were running for the shelter of the office buildings. Daniel saw Cheng amongst them. His blue safari suit was distinctive, even in the rain mist. Before he could get a shot at him, Cheng reached the building and ducked through the front door. Daniel turned his attention back to the four escaping Land Rovers. They had almost reached the main road into the forest, and the fire that the Uhali commando was turning upon them was furious but inaccurate. It seemed to be totally ineffectual. With Morgan Tembe dead, they were blazing away without aiming, like the raw, untried recruits they truly were. Tafari was already out of range from where Daniel was perched in the mahogany tree. He was going to get clear away. The whole attack was becoming a fiasco. The Uhali were forgetting all their training. The plan was falling to pieces. The rising was doomed within minutes of beginning. At that moment, a huge yellow D-10 caterpillar lumbered out of the forest. "At least somebody's remembered his orders," Daniel snarled to himself. He was angry at his failure, taking the full blame on himself. The caterpillar tractor waddled forward, straddling the roadway, cutting off the flying convoy of Land Rovers. A small band of Uhali emerged from the forest and ran behind it, dressed in blue denim and other civilian clothing. They used the tractor as a barricade and opened fire on the leading Land Rover as it raced towards them. At close range, their concentrated fire was at last effective. Tafari, in the leading Land Rover, saw his escape cut off and spun the truck in a hard 180-degree turn. The other trucks followed him round. They came back across the open ground in a line, and they were within range again. Daniel fired at Tafari's head, but the Land Rover was doing 60 miles an hour and bouncing over the rough track. Daniel never saw the strike of his bullets, and the line of the Land Rovers tore away down the track that led to where the Momu units were working. That direction was a dead end. The road ended at the mining excavation. The situation had been retrieved from total disaster by the driver of the caterpillar tractor. By now, the column of Land Rovers was out of sight from where Daniel was perched in the mahogany tree. He left the rifle hanging on its strap and swung out of the branch. He used the nylon rope to abseil down the trunk of the tree, kicking himself outwards with both feet, dropping so swiftly that the rope scorched the palms of his hands. As he hit the ground, Seppu ran forward and handed him his AK-47 assault rifle and the haversack that contained the spare magazines and four M-26 grenades. "Where's Karakai?" he demanded, and Seppu pointed back into the forest. They ran together. 200 yards further into the forest, Kelly was crouched over the VHF radio transmitter. She jumped up when she saw Daniel. "What's happened?" she shouted. "Did you get him?" "It's a total balls-up," Daniel told her grimly. "Tafari's still out there. We haven't got control of the radio station at Wengu." "Oh, God, what happens now?" "Transmit," he made the decision. "Give Victor the go-ahead. We're committed now. We can't turn back." "But if Tafari..." "Damn it, Kelly, just do it. I'm going to try and retrieve the ball. At least Tafari didn't get clear away. We're still in with a chance. For the present, we've got him bottled up here at Wengu." Kelly did not argue again. She knelt beside the radio set and lifted the microphone to her lips. "Forest base, this is Mushroom. Forest base, this is Mushroom. Do you read me?" The portable transmitter did not have the range to reach Kahali on the lakeshore direct. They must relay through the more powerful set at Gondala. "Mushroom, this is forest base. Mushroom, this is forest base." The voice of Kelly's male nurse from the Gondala clinic came back immediately. He was a trusted Uhali retainer of many years' standing. "This is a relay for Silverhead in Kahali. Message reads, 'The sun has risen.' I say again, 'The sun has risen.'"
"Is stand by, Mushroom."
There were a few minutes' silence, then Gondala came back on the air.
"A Mushroom, Silverhead acknowledges. The sun has risen."
The revolution was launched. Within the hour, Victor Omeru would be on television announcing it to the nation. But Tafari was still alive.
"Kelly, listen to me." Daniel took her arm and dragged her up
to face him, making sure he had all her attention. "Stay here. Try and keep in contact with Gondala. Don't go wandering off. Tafari stormtroopers will be scattered everywhere. Stay here until I come back for you." She nodded. "Be careful, darling."
"Seppu."
Daniel looked down at the little man. "Stay here. Look after Karakai."
"I with my life," Seppu told him.
"Kiss me,"
Kelly demanded of Daniel. "Or just a quick one. More to follow," Daniel promised. He left her and ran back towards the UDC buildings. Before he had gone 100 yards, he heard men in the forest ahead. "Omeru!" he shouted. It was the password. "Omeru!" they shouted back. "The sun has risen!" "Not yet, it bloody hasn't," Daniel muttered, and went forward. There were 12 men of the commando. The blue denim jackets were almost a uniform. "Come on!" he gathered them up. Before they reached the road, they ran down to the mining cut. He had 30 men with him. The rain had stopped by now, and Daniel paused on the edge of the forest. Before them stretched the endless plain of churned earth that the Momu units had devoured. The line of machines was ahead of them, ranged along the boundary where forest and red mud met. They looked like a line of battleships in a storm. Closer still were the 4 Land Rovers, scattered at abandoned angles on the muddy plain. As Daniel watched, the Hyter guards were straggling across the open ground towards the nearest Momu. Daniel recognized Ephraim Tafari's tall, uniformed figure leading them. It was clear that he had selected the nearest Momu as the most readily defensible strong point available to him, and Daniel conceded grimly that it was a good choice. The steel sides of the gigantic machine would offer almost complete protection from small arms fire. Even the RPG rockets would make no impression on its massive construction. To reach it, an attacker would have to cross soft, open ground that could be covered by fire from the upper platforms of Momu. Just as important, the steel fortress was manoeuvrable. Once he was in control of it, Tafari could drive it anywhere. Daniel looked about him quickly. By now, there were 50 or so Uhali guerrillas congregated around him. They were noisy and overexcited, behaving like green troops after their first taste of fire. Some of them were cheering and firing at the distant figures of Tafari and his guards. They were well out of range, and it was a dangerous waste of their precious stocks of ammunition. There was no point in trying to get them under control. He had to attack before they lost their wild spirits, and before Tafari reached the Momu and organized its defense.
"Come on!" Daniel shouted. "Omeru! The sun has risen!"
He led them out onto the open ground, and they followed him in a rabble, cheering wildly.
"Omeru!" they yelled.
Daniel had to keep the momentum going. The mud was ankle-deep in places, knee-deep in others. They passed the abandoned Land Rovers. Ahead of them, Daniel saw Tafari reach the Momu and haul himself up one of the steel boarding ladders. As they ploughed on through the mud, their progress slowed to a plodding walk. Tafari was organizing his men as they came aboard the Momu. They were taking cover behind the massive steel machinery. Bullets started slashing amongst the attackers, plugging into the mud, cracking around their heads. The man beside Daniel was hit. He went down face first in the mud. The attack slowed, bogging down in the mud. The Hyter on the Momu were lodging in, hidden behind steel bulkheads. They were shooting accurately, and more of Daniel's men were falling. The attack stalled. Some of the Uhali broke and started to stumble back towards the forest. Others crouched behind the stranded Land Rovers. They were not soldiers. They were clerks and truck drivers and university students faced by crack paratroopers in an impregnable steel fortress. Daniel could not blame them for breaking, even though the revolution was dying in the mud with them. He could not go on alone. Already the Hyter had singled him out. Their fire was concentrating on him. He stumbled back to the nearest Land Rover and crouched behind its chassis. He saw the crew of the Momu desert their stations and huddle helplessly on the lower platform. One of the Hyter paratroopers gestured to them imperiously, and with obvious relief they swarmed down the steel ladder and dropped into the mud like sailors abandoning a sinking ocean liner. The engine of the Momu was still running. The excavators were chewing into the earth, but now, with no direction, the gigantic rig was wandering out of its formation. The crews of the other rigs in the line saw what was happening, and they too abandoned their posts and streamed overboard, trying to escape the bursts of gunfire that rattled and clanged against the steel plating. It was a standoff. Tafari's men had command of the Mamu, and Daniel's commando was stalled in the mud, unable to advance or retreat. He tried to think of some way to break the impasse. He could not expect his shattered and demoralized survivors to mount another charge. Tafari had 15 or 20 men up there, more than enough to hold them off. At that moment he became aware of another eerie sound, like the mewling of seagulls or the cry of lost souls. He looked back, and at first saw nothing. Then something moved at the edge of the forest. At first he could not make it out. It was not human, surely. Then he saw other movement. The forest was coming alive. Thousands of strange creatures, as numerous as insects, like a column of safari ants on the march. They were red in their myriads, and the wild plaintive cry rose louder and more urgently from them as they swarmed out of the forest into the open. Suddenly he realized what he was seeing. The gates of the labour camps were open. The guards had been overwhelmed, and the Yuhali slaves had risen out of the mud. They were red with it, coated with it, naked as corpses exhumed from the grave, starved to stick-like emaciation. They swarmed forward in their legions, in their thousands, women and men and children, sexless in their coating of mud, only their white and angry eyes glaring in the muddy red masks of their faces. "Omeru!" they cried, and the sound was like a stormy sea on a rocky headland. The fire of the Haita paratroopers was blanketed by the roar of their voices. The bullets of the AK-47 assault rifles made no impression on the densely packed ranks. Where one man fell, a dozen more swarmed forward to replace him. On the Mamu fortress, the Haita guards were running out of ammunition. Even at this distance, Daniel could sense their panic. They threw aside their empty rifles, the barrels hot as though from the furnace. Unarmed, they climbed the steel ladders to the highest platform of the ungainly yellow rig. Helplessly they stood at the railing and watched the naked red horde reach the machine and climb up towards them. Daniel recognized Ephraim Tafari amongst the Haita on the upper deck. He was trying to speak to the slaves, spreading his arms in an oratorial gesture, trying to reason with them. In the end, when the front rank was almost upon him, Tafari drew his pistol and fired down into them. He kept firing as they engulfed him. For a time, Daniel lost him in the struggling red mass of naked humanity. He was like a fry absorbed by a gigantic jellyfish. Then he saw Tafari again, lifted high above the heads of the mob by hundreds of upraised arms. They passed him forward, struggling wildly. Then they hurled him from the top of the Mamu. Ephraim Tafari turned in the air, ungainly as a bird trying to fly with a broken wing. He dropped 70 feet into the spinning silver blades of the excavator head. The blade sucked him in, and in a single instant chopped him to a paste so fine that his blood did not leave so much as a stain on the wet earth. Daniel stood up slowly. On the Mamu they were killing the Haita paratroopers, tearing them to pieces with their bare hands, swarming over them, screaming and exulting. Daniel turned away. He started back towards where he had left Kelly. His progress was slow. Men of the commando clustered around him, shaking his hand, thumping him on the back, laughing and shouting and singing. There was still some desultory small arms fire in the forest. The administrative offices were on fire. Flames leapt high, crackling and pouring out black smoke. A roof collapsed. People were trapped in there, burning to death. The mob raged everywhere, chasing the guards and officials and engineers and clerks of the company, black and Taiwanese, anybody connected with the hated oppressor. They caught them and killed them, kicking and beating them as they writhed on the earth, hacking at them with spades or machetes, throwing their dismembered bodies into the flames. It was savage. It was Africa. Daniel turned away from the horror. One man could not stop the orgy. They had suffered too long. Their hatred was too fierce. He left the track and went into the forest to find Kelly. He had not gone 100 yards before he saw a small figure running towards him through the trees. "Seppu!" he called, and the pygmy darted to his side and seized his arm and shook it. "Ikarakai!" he screeched incoherently. There was a gash in his scalp, and he was bleeding heavily. "Where is she?" Daniel demanded. "What's happened to her?" "Karakai! He has taken her! He has taken her into the forest.